when I asked people to stay behind, I obviously went to them individually and asked if they'd be interested. I mean, that's like, look, option A is you can get a job at Wayfair that pays you the same as what you make here, and we paid quite well. And option B is you can come with me and hope for the best, and maybe we'll make a new business. And everyone asked me the same question.
Go for it.
The five people I approached all asked me who else I was asking and whether they said yes or no. And when I told them who else I was asking, they were like, I'm in.
Bienvenue au 28e épisode du podcast Hypercroissance, présenté et produit par G7 Media, une agence de publicité Facebook. En gérant près de 1 million de dollars de publicité Facebook par mois, G7 Media aide depuis 8 ans maintenant les entreprises à accélérer leur croissance via l'entremise de la publicité Facebook et Instagram. Si vous êtes un commerce en ligne et que vous désirez passer de croissance à hypercroissance, rendez-vous au www.j7media.com et demandez à parler avec un de nos conseillers. En l'espace de quelques jours seulement, notre équipe saura vous bâtir un plan de match afin de faire grandir votre entreprise. Vous l'avez certainement remarqué dans l'introduction, le podcast d'aujourd'hui est exceptionnellement en anglais. Mes contacts en affaires et également les gens que j'admire en entrepreneuriat sont souvent des anglophones, donc il se peut que plusieurs podcasts dans l'avenir soient également dans la langue de Shakespeare. Ceci étant dit, revenons au vif du sujet. Mon invité aujourd'hui, Seth Rosen, va vous raconter l'histoire atypique que son entreprise Custom Made a vécue lors des 11 dernières années. Après avoir levé près de 30 millions de dollars avec des investisseurs externes, Seth Rosen a décidé en 2015 de vendre son organisation à Wayfair avant de racheter une partie des assets existants qui lui ont permis de construire une entreprise spécialisée en conception de bijoux de luxe qui risque d'atteindre les 10 millions de chiffre d'affaires en 2020. En plus d'être un entrepreneur à succès, Seth a également connu une carrière comme investment banker qui lui a permis de parfaire ses connaissances dans la négociation d'ententes complexes. Vous allez d'ailleurs voir le processus qu'il suit à la lettre afin d'acquérir d'autres entreprises parce que oui, Seth possède également d'autres organisations. Sans plus attendre, ma discussion avec Seth Rosen. Seth Rosen, you are the CEO of Custom Made. For people who do not know, Custom Made is an online platform where you can custom from A to Z your engagement ring with jewelry experts. You started the company in 2009 and you raised close to $30 million with VC from Google Venture, Atlas Ventures, and Schooner Capital. You also bought in 2012 the leading gemology website called International Gem Society that gets more than 5 million website visitors per year. You continued your acquisitions by acquiring another very popular website in the jewelry space called Genoxen. Seth Rosen, thanks for being with us on the podcast today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so Seth, I'm very excited to have this conversation with you today. I think people who are listening will be quite fascinated as well with the evolution that Custom Made had in the past 10 years. But before we talk about Custom Made, can you tell me more on your career as an investment banker? Because I think this job helped you a lot for being the entrepreneur that you are today.
Sure. So yeah, I mean, I started my career as a structured debt capital markets investment banker, so primarily in the commercial real estate space. So basically, I was helping commercial real estate investors, primarily larger investors, capitalize their projects. So debt and equity capital to build hotels, for example, or develop office buildings or purchase and reposition office buildings. So we would assist them in locating capital. And then one of the, there were numerous sources of that capital, but one of the primary sources of capital at the time, this is pre-financial crisis, was capital that was sourced from investment banks that would then sell it as bonds. So securitization, basically commercial securities, commercial mortgage securitization, so an asset-backed securitization. So I spent a lot of time assisting people in finding capital and telling their story to capital providers, and also basically matching up, because it's investment banking is just brokerage, it's a service business, matching up people who need capital with different types of capital and understanding how to package up a story and sell it, basically.
Okay.
To the right capital provider. So that was the first phase of my career. I did that from, I think I started when I was 22. I did it until I was 29. It was then called Meredith and Grew. We sold it to First Service Corporation out of Canada I don't remember, geez, maybe 2000. I think we closed, the deal closed in 2008. I was a minority shareholder. There were much, much larger shareholders than me, but I became a partner at 26 when I was 26. I was the youngest shareholder in the history of the firm. Oh. Been around since the 1870s was when it was started. So it was a pretty exciting path. I learned a tremendous amount, worked with some unbelievable people, learned a tremendous amount from people I worked with about sales and transaction structuring and stuff like that. So yeah, it was a great run. Did that. And that was the first part of my career prior to being an internet entrepreneur.
Yeah, I saw the V1, the V2. I found that interesting on your LinkedIn. So you tell me other things that you made. I think you made yourself a lot of contacts in this space before. And these contacts help you after that a little bit for your second career as an entrepreneur, this time for buying different businesses. We're going to get there for Custom-Made. But can you tell me basically what you learned? What has been the most important thing for you that you learned with your career as an investment banker before switching to being an entrepreneur?
Yeah, I mean, I think two things really. So one, I was pretty detail oriented and very interested in the technical aspects of the transactions that I was doing. A lot of brokers, surprisingly, you do need to be quite technical as an investment banker, but less so than you might think. Okay. On the legal side, and depending on what you're doing, of course, but you can get by without being that technically interested, especially as you get to be more senior. So I found that it was a large advantage for me to be very deeply interested in all the technical aspects of the transaction, specifically the legal and tax implications of various transactions. So that interest in being technical and detail-oriented has followed me throughout my career and caused me to identify different opportunities than I otherwise might. So that was one thing that I learned. And I think the second thing that I learned is that probably even more important is that relationships ultimately drive value in business and in life. So if you're cultivating relationships because you need something or you want something, like, you, it's not going to work. I mean, I focused very much on finding people who were similarly inclined and hung out with them. And, you know, I happen to, I really enjoy the business stuff. Like, that's what I want to talk about.
Of course.
I do in my spare time, you know, because you're constantly fielding a lot of my nonsense. So, yeah, I think that's it. I just built those relationships, and those relationships have stayed with me. And frankly, I've been in many a circumstance over the last more than a decade now where, you know, some people who I had genuine relationships with no expectation that they would ever be helpful to me ended up being the difference between life and death from a business perspective on numerous occasions. So
yeah, literally, you told me that. I think we'll get there at some point. It's very, very interesting, this topic. So yeah, okay, so finally the company has been sold just before the financial crisis, or literally in the financial crisis?
Yeah, I mean, literally in the financial crisis. I think it was.
Okay.
I think they closed the transaction. It's a Canadian company that bought it. I think they closed the transaction after right after the financial crisis, but it was like right in the midst of the financial crisis. I was not involved in the negotiations. I was such a junior partner, but yeah, I mean, we had one major transaction. We had financed, me and a fellow named Kevin Phelan, had financed the Mandarin Oriental Hotel here in Back Bay in Boston, a very large hotel, multi-$100 million transaction. We'd financed it several times. We did the construction loan, then we did an equity recapitalization, then we did another equity recapitalization. So it was a really interesting transaction, but that actually closed in the midst of 2008 too. So it was a crazy time because, you know, there was a massive crash, and
of course,
knew if anything was going to close. And, you know, I give a tremendous amount of credit to the guys that negotiated the transaction and got Meredith and Grew sold, because no one knew if it was going to close. And when we were
doing the
whole transaction, no one knew if that was going to close. It was crazy time.
But would you say that, because right now we're recording this podcast on May 1st, 2020, so we're literally in this COVID-19 crisis, would you say that this financial crisis has something similar to what we're living right now, or it's two complete different things business-wise, right?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think they're different. I think in some ways this is not as bad. In other ways, this is much worse.
Okay.
But, you know, it's very difficult to compare this to that. I mean, I was right in the thick of 2000. I mean, we knew. It wasn't like nobody knew.
Of course.
2006 that this was crazy, right? Like, we were doing transactions and we were getting bids on these transactions. You had people buying buildings, refinancing, making $20, $30, $40 million in a year. I mean, it was just absolute madness. The valuations were crazy and everyone knew like it can't go on.
So you saw it?
Oh, years in advance. I was talking.
Okay, years in advance.
I published papers on it. You can go read them. 2006, I was talking about the defeasance of securitized commercial mortgages and, you know, I was like, these pools are ridiculous.
Everyone, oh my God, okay.
I mean, you know, but we made some money. We made some money on that too.
Of course.
You know.
Of course. Okay, interesting. So look, so the company has been sold in 2008. And then if I'm looking at my notes right now, you bought the domain, you bought custom made in 2009. So what happened between the moment that the company has been sold and the moment that you started your entrepreneur career? Did you tell yourself, okay, maybe it's time that I jump and then I become an entrepreneur? Is it something that you always wanted to do before? What happened in your head at that time?
Yeah, it's something I always wanted to do. I mean, at the end of the day, like being an investment banker, it's interesting. It's great, right? Like you definitely make a lot of money, especially if you're good at it. The difference between people who are like, it's crazy, the disparity, right? Like everyone, you make a decent living no matter what, but some people just make do a lot better than other people, right? So like at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. It's still a service business. It's still a sales job.
Of course.
Like, it's a fancier sales job, but it's still sales. So you're still beholden to someone else. Mm-hmm. And it's ultimately not yours. Like it's still a service business. And as you know from working with me, I am a very unique personality, I guess is how politely describe myself. And, you know, I just needed to do my own thing. And that's what I always wanted to do. I didn't really know how I wanted to do that. And so I ended up, you know, I thought the internet was going to be a pretty big thing. It was already, I mean, it's not like in 2008, people weren't using the internet. Like, you know, I was like,
yeah, of course,
a web-based company because it scales well. And I found it because I was buying a custom coffee table. I was always into custom furniture. I've always been into custom stuff. And I ran across this website, custommade.com. I met a woodworker on there who made me this coffee table. And I was like, wow, like, this is crazy. Like, tell me about how many leads do you get from this website? Because, like, this website seems to have all the furniture makers on it. And he's like, yeah, I get all my leads from this website. I was like, wow. He's like, how much do you pay? He's like, I pay $35 a year. It's like, well, how much is all of your business?
Just to be listed on Custom Made website at that time.
Yeah, because Custom Made had great domain authority. And so he put his stuff up there. It ranked really well. And people started calling him. You know, they made his phone ring for $35 a year. I was like, well, geez, like, if I charge you $300 a year, would you pay it? He's like, hell yeah. I'm like, that seems like a good business, you know? And unlike real estate, you could keep selling subscriptions if you can keep supporting those subscriptions with additional leads.
Of course, literally.
I didn't fully appreciate how complicated that dynamic would become. But I mean, literally, like, I went to computer camp, but I didn't know what the hell I was doing, you know? But it's fine. We figured some stuff out. It was a very interesting time.
So you bought the company. So let's say you had the conversation with this guy. What happened after? How did you buy the company at some point?
Yeah. Well, I was like, you know, it's interesting. I gotta give a lot of credit to my co-founder, to Tom, who like, he's just a super persistent guy. Best man, this guy, Mike Salguero. So I was like, Mike, we should buy this thing. We should get this website. And Mike just hounded this guy until he sold his business. The guy was like, no. And we were like, great, I'm calling you. Well, it sounds like you're interested. And so I called him a couple times, was like, he doesn't want to sell. And Mike kind of kept in touch with him. And when the market crashed in late 2008, he was ready to sell. And then Mike and I got together and we purchased the business.
Oh, so how long? Tell me a little bit how long the process took just to get the guy saying, going from a no to a yes.
Maybe 6 or 7 months.
Okay. Interesting. And you were calling him every week?
No, I think we were talking to him periodically.
Okay.
But you know, the I think the key learning there is it's always hilarious to me. Like people expect things to happen so fast.
Yeah.
it's like, this stuff takes a lot of time. It's like, yeah, literally. He said no. And then he said no again. And then he said no again. And then he said no again. But eventually he said yes. And we just kept in touch with him. And that's what brokerage is too, by the way. Like, there are clients who are like, no. And we're like, okay, great. I'm going to keep in touch with you.
Right? Of course.
It's so funny because half the time, more than half the time, if you just stay in touch and build a relationship, eventually something happens. And if you build a portfolio of those people that you're staying in touch with, not in an inappropriate way, not in a like, I want to get something from you, so I'm going to keep calling type of way, which is how most people approach it. It's more like, listen, I'm here. I'm interested in this. When you're ready, I'm interested in talking to you.
And just stay top of mind, like bring value, stay top of mind. And then at some point, if the transaction is supposed to happen, the transaction will happen, right?
Right. And presumably you have enough irons in the fire that you always have something going on. This is so funny. People are like, how did you find that? Oh my gosh. It's like, dude, I got 100 things that I'm tracking all the time. It's not that hard. It's not like I have a pen and a paper. I have a freaking computer. Like, it's not difficult to keep track of things, you know? But, and look, I see a ton of opportunities that they don't work for some reason. Either the person wants too much money or, you know, I look at stuff all the time. I say no to so much stuff. It costs me nothing to look at stuff.
Literally. Yeah.
You know, you just can't be lazy. And that's the thing is like, that's what brokerage taught me. Like, there's no room for laziness. Like, you need to get on the phone, make something happen, put it together.
And don't stop. Okay. So, interesting story. So you finally, the guy say yes, 2009, you buy custom made. And from there, like I mentioned it earlier in the podcast, you raise, I think in 5 or 6 years, close to $30 million. So what happens from there? You buy the company. Do you already have a vision where you want to bring this company right away? Tell me a little bit about the start of the business.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first we just raised some friends and family money and we put in some of our own money, right? And actually we built the business quite nicely. The first iteration version of the business was just a subscription business that worked pretty darn well.
Basically people, they pay, like you said, $35, $50 a year just to be on the website. And then you can bring them leads with custom made. Did you have like a specific vertical at that time, or you had a lot of verticals?
Yeah, I mean, it was all woodworkers when we bought it.
Woodworkers, okay.
It was just people who did furniture makers and cabinet makers, primarily. And many of whom, by the way, I'm still friends with. Like, I have friends from, you know, you'd be amazed, like, you know, because these things, you build a portfolio of friends over time. And so, we didn't really raise venture capital for it until 2011. And basically this is what happened, right? We started building the subscription business. It was working. We were good at selling these maker subscriptions. And we said, geez, like, there's a lot of transactions happening as a result of the introductions we're making, right? We've got this organic traffic and we've got these makers and we're putting them together and we're charging an annual fee. And of course, as you might guess, like, some people pay $300 a year and they get $300,000 a year worth of value. And some people pay $300 a year and get no value. That's how big the disparity is, right? So very difficult for this to scale. So we're like, you know what? Let's just align our interests with the interests of the makers. We will only charge them when they get work that transacts.
Okay. So a fee every transaction.
Yeah, we're going to get a piece of the transaction. And so we went through and we said, well, like, let's look at the messages. And we said, well, let's assume that if 1 in 20 of these turns into a transaction and the average order value is $2,000, then we already have $25 million worth of transactions happening through the platform. Imagine if we got 10% of that, we'd be 10 times the size tomorrow. So we're going to eliminate all the subscription revenue and we're going to take a piece of the transaction.
Interesting.
Turns out this was a dramatic mistake, but it sounds plausible. And it was the story that resonated with venture capital providers. And we kept changing our story. Because we were very inexperienced. We didn't really know what a great business looks like, which was a key learning. We just kept adjusting our story until we found something that resonated with our counterparty, with our capital providers. And marketplaces were hot, right? Everybody wanted to be invested in a market. It was like the, you know, there's been a million of these things. It's the marketplaces, you probably don't remember half of this stuff. Group buying, flash sales. I could name a million new unbelievable trends. And you know,
it was a shiny object.
Yeah, it's the new shiny object.
Interesting.
Like machine learning, AI, you know, this meaningless nonsense that like people are like, oh, it's a Yeah, what we do is we dynamically, it's like, what are you talking about?
That's
AI. You don't need AI to solve that problem.
Are you making money? That's the real question, right?
do the fundamentals of the business work? Do you add value to your customer?
Like, of course.
It's seventh grade math and common sense. And I think a lot of people try to overcomplicate a lot of this stuff. And some of it is necessarily complex. There are certainly applications for things like machine learning and AI. I'm not pretending there aren't, but, I learned that don't try to fit what you're doing that may actually be an elegant but simple solution into some complicated box, because that's what people want to perceive it as, right? Do what's totally necessary to drive value, to drive enterprise value creation in the business. That's what you should do.
Of course. I agree. Okay. So just to be sure, did you switch the business model from annual recurring to just, every time there's a transaction, you have a fee on this? So you did that? You did the change?
Yes, we did. Yep.
Oh my God. Okay. So you did that before you pitched to the VC or while you were pitching to the VC?
No, that was the pitch for what we were going to do and why we needed venture capital.
Ah, okay. Interesting.
We were going to so the pitch literally is, I'm going to eliminate all my revenue, but I'm going to create this new revenue stream by standing in the middle of these transactions.
Wow. Now, so tell me more. What happened?
This ain't a simple transaction, right? If you think about a custom project, someone has to come in, they have to talk to a maker. Usually they're talking to multiple makers. They don't really understand what they want. The project can't be priced until it's specified. Different people price things differently. Some people are just bad business people, so they price things poorly. And the customer doesn't know the difference, so they pick the cheapest price because they think it's a commodity. And there's all of these very complex dynamics that you've now decided you're going to involve yourself in. And there's a cost associated with that. Complexity has a cost. And so you have to get paid for it. The more complex stuff you do, the more you have to get paid. But I was young and dumb and I didn't really understand what a good model looked like. So this is what we decided we were going to do.
So yeah. So what happened? Tell me more.
Yeah. So we started standing in the middle of these transactions and, we learned, I sort of skipped to the key learnings, right? If you're going to make something totally from scratch every single time, all things being equal, that should be a bad business. Right, you really want to make a whole bunch of something because you capture economies of scale, and you want to sell it to a whole bunch of people and repeat, or not, or only make something when you get an order, right, just in time. It's just there's a lot of soft costs associated with customizing something for each customer.
Yeah, totally.
But there's a lot of magic created if you can do it, and you can do it profitably. The problem is, you really can't do it at a low order value. Because the soft costs of the back and forth have to be absorbed in the margin. And if you're going to do it online, you need something that's inherently specifiable. So jewelry, we found through many millions I can give you 30 million reasons why jewelry is the best of the vertical markets for full custom. Jewelry is really a very special vertical market because I can specify it online. I can model it on the computer in 3D. Mm-hmm. And the same file, the same computer file that shows you what you're going to get, creates a specification. The output is both an image that you can see as the consumer, and the output of the file is the input into the manufacturing process.
Clearly.
Because I create the piece from the same file that I show you I show you what you're going to get. So those are very special dynamics. Now think about making a table. It's like, these are the shop drawings, but this is what the cut list is going to look like, but it's kind of going to look like this, but not really. I might change some things while I make it. Like, it's a nightmare, right? So jewelry is sort of a special vertical market where full custom at large scale is feasible. It's still operationally very complex, but...
You are there now, and you're very successful at it with Custom8, but clearly... It was not exactly where you were in 2011, 2012 when you raised your money. And then at some point, I saw that you sold the company to Wayfair in 2015. So can you tell me what happened between, you change your business model, only make money every time there's a transaction. Okay, so you only charge for fees for transactions. You sold the company to Wayfair in 2015. In 2020, you're now generating so many leads with custom made with the jewelry vertical. Tell me a little bit the process. What happened between all these years? Because it's a big, big pivot.
Yeah, I think it seems big when you look at it from the outside, but really it became pretty obvious what we should do.
Okay.
We were watching all of it. We had 24,000 makers on the website, right?
Wow.
And so we had a tremendous amount of data about what was and wasn't working. We watched tons of interactions between customers and makers, and you can see bright as day, like what is and isn't working, right? Like, it's like, yeah, the reason this guy's upset is because you shipped him a table and the table broke, and you don't make enough money when you made the table from scratch to actually support the customer after you ship them the table.
Of course.
You know, it turns out you look at the data and you're like, holy crap, like almost 50% of furniture is damaged in shipping. It's like, okay, that's a bad vertical. You know why? Because the table is really heavy and it's hard to ship. We shouldn't do that. It's a bad business, right? Like, and by the way, I mean, Wayfair is an interesting example. I mean, they will be the first to tell you that shipping furniture and getting it there in one piece ain't easy. It's extremely difficult. There's a reason Amazon has fallen dramatically behind in the online furniture business. It's very difficult, right? So, we watched the transactions and we just concluded that there's really only one vertical market that works. So it's not so much that we sold the business to Wayfair. It's quite a complicated transaction, but about 45 employees at the time moved over to Wayfair. Five employees of the old entity stayed behind. We purchased back the assets in partnership with a company called Western Technology Investment out of Palo Alto. It's the largest venture debt fund in the world, I think. They were our debt provider in the first version of the business, and they became our new partner on a jewelry business. We basically said, look, we have this marketplace, it doesn't work, but there's the germ of something here that could work really nicely. And the problem is it doesn't work if you have a whole bunch of independent jewelers talking to a whole bunch of customers. You're basically taking a guy, and the average jeweler, the person who makes jewelry, is either really good at marketing and sales and not so good at making the stuff, or really good at making the stuff and not so good at marketing and sales. Almost nobody does both. And if they do, they don't need the website.
Of course.
So you have there's a lot of selection bias in the pool of people who choose to interact and transact on custom made. And that's a big problem, right? Basically, what we concluded is we just need to be the jeweler. We don't need to get a bunch of customers and help them select the right jeweler. Because what we realized is customers don't actually care who the jeweler is, like the actual guy who's making it. It sounds bad and it isn't that romantic, but people don't care. Like, people want someone to deliver an incredibly high quality product at an incredible price, and then they want someone to stand behind the product. That's 99.9% of customers. What we were pitching in the marketplace was, you're going to get to have a relationship with the person who's making the thing that you're buying, and people don't want that. Not in a bad way. It's just, that's not the mass market. The mass market doesn't know what they want. That's why merchandising exists, right? You know this better than anybody. You merchandise for a living in the form of Facebook ads.
Of course, literally.
So, yeah, we just learned that the hard way, and we've kind of meandered to, it wasn't like we sat down, you know, we didn't sit down and have some grand vision of, oh, you know what we need to do? I've got it. I've got the idea, guys. Sorry, you know? It's like,
it never happened like that, right?
Yeah,
it doesn't happen like that.
You meander your way and you lean into what works. You double down on the stuff that's working and you stop doing the stuff that sucks. I'm sure you do that. I'm sure everybody listening does that, you know, and it's just the judgment to be like, to stop leaning into things that are fundamentally, that just don't make sense. If you pick a good business, it's easier. If you pick a marginal business, you can probably get there, but it's going to be hard. And if you pick a bad business, it doesn't matter how good you are. You'll never get there.
I agree.
We picked the wrong model, and we picked a marginal market, and that's why we weren't successful. It wasn't that we had a bad team. It wasn't that we were super well capitalized. You know, I see a lot of people now raising, well, now with COVID less so, but for a while leading up to this, it was everybody and their brothers raising this capital. It's like, dude, I learned the hard way. Lots of capital doesn't fix fundamental problems.
They don't.
You just lose lots of capital. That's all that happens.
Exactly.
Money.
and at some point, you will lose relationship at the same time, right? Because if you're unable to deliver, people who gave you money in the first place, I'm not sure they will be your best friends in the future, right?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Like most of the people who invested with me, with the exception of the later venture capitalists, actually made money in our transaction. We did a series of transactions. So, but I think if you conduct yourself with integrity, I don't necessarily think the relationships are injured. I think if you don't conduct yourself with integrity, if you don't try your hardest, if you don't do everything you can, then I think you can definitely injure relationships.
Of course.
And you can prove that you're just not that swift through the process, which means people don't want to invest in you again. They may not, it's not that they dislike you. They just don't think you have the ability to make that money.
Clearly.
Fortunately, I don't think that happened to me. I don't think people would tell me if it did. So maybe it did.
Yeah. So let's say you bring back, or I'm not sure you're bringing back, but you keep some of your key employees. The other employees are going to Wayfair 2015. Is it accurate?
Yeah.
Okay. So in 2015, most of your employees are going to Wayfair. You keep 6-7 of them. Is it before most of your employees went to Wayfair that you had this idea that you needed to go into jewelry space?
It was, we didn't actually know exactly what we were going to do.
Okay.
We knew that if anything could be done in the custom space, that we had more data than anyone else. And we knew we would need to approach it with a very small team. So obviously we couldn't keep everyone. It's not that we weeded out the bad people and kept the only good ones or anything like that. We had tons of good people. In fact, if you look at where people have gone since leaving Custom Made version one, I mean, people have done, a lot of people do great things afterwards. So it's more that we needed a sort of SWAT team to figure out whether a new business could be built out of the ashes of the old. So that's what we did. I will say there was a learning moment for me when I asked people to stay behind. I obviously went to them individually and asked if they'd be interested. I mean, that's like, look, option A is you can get a job at Wayfair that pays you the same as what you make here, and we paid quite well. And option B is you can come with me and hope for the best, and maybe we'll make a new business. And everyone asked me the same question.
Go for it.
The five people I approached all asked me who else I was asking and whether they said yes or no. And when I told them who else I was asking, they were like, I'm in.
Oh my God.
And so what's the learning here, right? The learning is great people want to work with great people. Great people want to, I believe, engage and enroll in a culture of performance, in a culture of candor. They don't like politics. And they want to work with other great people. They want to feel like they are working with people certainly as good, but hopefully much better than they are. And it's a testament to the people I asked that they asked that question. And it showed me that if you have a team of 20 and you have one person who isn't pulling their weight, who isn't doing well, that person's got to go. There's just no other way to do it. Like bad people stick around forever. Poor performers stick around forever. They're like a cancer.
They clearly are.
Company, and they'll kill your company. It grows. It expands.
Because your A players will look at them and be like, hey, why do we have these people in our team? And then at some point, it will look at the boss and the CEO and be like, hey, you're a coward of not letting these people go. You see that it doesn't improve the company at some point, right?
Yeah, it's also like the way we look at it is hiring is the most important thing we do. There's no amount of time that we're unwilling to spend. There's no amount of money we're unwilling to invest in making a right decision on hiring. So ultimately, you can be the smartest person in our company. If you don't hire, manage, and improve the people underneath you, you are not good. Because one person only has so much leverage. There's only so many hours in the day. Your ability to locate, inspire, cultivate leaders, like, you know, is a direct, that's what tells me whether you're a leader or not. Like, that's what tells me whether you are a leverage player or whether you're, you know, just someone who's a core contributor. So that's ultimately how we judge people. So if you saw our hiring process, you'd be like, that's crazy.
Oh, really?
It's just very involved, right? We do a variation of top grading. We spend a tremendous amount of time, a lot of time. And it's hard because, listen, if you're buried, you know, right? You have tons of clients. You have more clients who want to use you. You're buried. You just need freaking help. What do you want to do? You want to go out and get some help. You have the money already. It's ready to be given to you. You just need someone so that you could take the money. That's pretty tempting. It's pretty tempting to be like, we just got to get somebody in here. We got to get somebody in here to do this. That's a mistake. You have to be like, no, we'll hire when we, first of all, did you scope the role? Did you spend, I could go on and on about hiring, but the key is the culture you build and the quality of your people is directly related to the results you're able to deliver.
Very interesting. So, okay. So you bring these people, or let's say you keep these people 2015. Now, what happened from 2015 to 2020? How, you know, what happened in the evolution of Custom-Made? Because now it's going very well, but I guess a lot of different small steps happen during this V2 of the company, right?
Yeah. I mean, five of us got in a room and we're like, okay, good news. We used to own a really small piece of this business that we were just trying to get to work. Now we own a very large piece of this business. It's the same business, but we can do anything we want with it. What do you guys want to do?
Oh, really?
That's what we did. Right? What do we want to build? And so necessity is the mother of invention. We changed the way we did business. We pretty quickly realized we wanted to be in the custom jewelry business. It was the only vertical that was going to work. And we began building that system. We started making jewelry ourselves, literally making it ourselves. And so making a piece of jewelry is quite complex. I mean, we actually are a manufacturer. It is very difficult to manufacture this stuff. It is especially difficult if you're prototyping, because we're in the prototyping business. If you come and you want an engagement ring, I actually make it from scratch for you. I don't pretend to make it from scratch. I don't give you some stupid thing that makes it feel like it's special, but it's not really special. It is. It's actually for you. And it means more because we make it for you and we build a relationship with you, right? We build a real relationship with our customers. Ultimately, our business is super simple. I make you so incredibly happy on a project that means a tremendous amount to you. We're not selling you widgets. Like, this is your engagement ring. And through the process of co-creating it with you, you come to fall in love, I hope, with us and our process. And if you tell one friend, that's worth an absolute fortune to me economically. But much more importantly, it crystallizes our mission. We just don't fuck around with customer happiness.
Exactly. That's the most important thing, right?
Yeah, I didn't mean to say customer happiness.
No, it's fine. It's fine.
you have to, right? I mean, because you know better than anybody. Like, you are always figuring out a way to get that last penny out of customer acquisition, and it's hard to make a profit. Got a lot of people buying the same leads. The leads are expensive. And if you tell a friend, A, they're much more likely to convert.
Of course.
Right, of course. They are more likely to spend more, and they come in, they already trust you. They already want to do business with you for good reason, because you did a great job for their friend.
I'm curious, Seth, do you have a number of how many customers do you get from this word of mouth thing? Do you have these numbers?
Yes, I do.
Oh, we track it. Interesting.
It's a very interesting number though, right? Because if you think about our business, we have a long, I mean, you know this because you help us with advertising, but we have a very long sales cycle.
Yeah, very long.
But the tail of our sales cycle can be quite long because people come in, they think about getting engaged, you know, then they're quarantined with their girlfriend. They wonder if they actually want to do this. You know, and then they come back 3 months later and they end up getting engaged, right? Like,
yeah.
Obviously I'm joking, but you know, it's a decision process.
Of course.
And that means not only does it take people time to convert, which means you need a lot of data to figure out how much someone's worth, but it also takes a lot of time for somebody to repeat, because it's a large transaction, it takes a long time for someone to refer. So we really started in earnest in this business in 2016, and you have to think about a 2016 cohort, and you have to measure of that cohort of 2016, what percentage has repeated. And obviously, as you march through time, the number of people who repeat in the 2016 cohort grows because you've had more time to tell a friend, right?
And interesting.
So, you know, the 2016 cohort is our oldest indicator, but we're now starting to see 2017, 2018, 2019, but it takes years to figure out what repeat and referral does for your business. So you can manage to the numbers. I'll tell you what the numbers are in a second, but you can manage to the numbers, but honestly, you don't even bother. You manage to the anecdotal, we manage to an anecdotal standard. And that anecdotal standard is, would I feel comfortable sending a friend or a family member into our process completely unassisted? Would I feel comfortable sending someone to my website that I know personally, who I have a meaningful invested interest in them having a great experience without me monitoring it? If the answer is yes, then we're doing a good job. And you could, that will manifest itself in higher repeat and referral numbers. So the answer to the specific question you asked is, in 2016, about 23% of our gross merchandise volume that we can track has repeated or referred, meaning we had $100,000 of sales in 2016. We got $23,000 in sales in the ensuing time period. Now, keep in mind, referral is extremely difficult to measure.
It is. It is.
You can ask people, but they won't tell you. And you'd be shocked.
Of course.
Sometimes we don't even know until the review. Like, there's a lot of referral we get that's not in those numbers, because we'll read a review and it's like, yeah, my brother-in-law got his ring here and he told me I should use you guys. And then I'm so glad I did. It's like, well, why didn't you put that in the goddamn drop-down menu when we asked you how you heard about us? You selected. But you're not in the numbers. You know what I mean?
Like, of course. Yeah.
And, you know, people ask us, it's usually inexperienced people talking to it as, well, you should have a referral program. You give someone $50 if they refer a friend. It's like, I know that sounds good.
But it's not.
It's so stupid. It's like, dude, if you do something that you love and you're just like thrilled with a company, you're going to tell a friend. You don't want $50 from us. Like,
you don't want that. Especially for an engagement ring, right? It's like one of the most important things that you have in life, that you will keep for all your life. You're just happy to share the good news. You're not looking to get $50 in your pocket for that. You're just happy to share the good news with everyone you know.
Right. That's why we don't bother with it. We don't have a program. We don't pay you anything.
Exactly.
If you're happy, tell someone. If you're not happy, tell us and we will fix it. If we lose money fixing it, we will lose money to fix it. You will leave happy because everyone leaves happy. No exception.
You have to. You're in this business. You're in this business, right? People cannot be unhappy with an engagement ring.
And by the way, you can't just be like, oh yeah, we tried to ship it. I don't know why it didn't get there on time. Like, dude, the guy's going to New York to get engaged. He's got a whole plan and get his ring there on time. It's not an option.
Of course.
There's no, you can see why being a marketplace for something like this would be a total nightmare. If it goes badly, the customer blames anyone because the maker is like, I tried my best.
No. It's impossible.
It's impossible. You have to be able to fix it yourself.
And interesting.
So
tell me how you grew, because you're five people in a room in 2015. You take the decision to go in one specific vertical. You know, it has been a good decision if you're looking at it 5 years later. Tell me, what happened from there and how big you are right now? What kind of different, like I said, steps that you took from there? Because I think that's very fascinating.
Yeah. So we obviously recruited over time. We were very fortunate. We started with a good organic footprint. We got a bunch of leads and we pretty much doubled the business every year. It was obviously the first 2 or 3 million was kind of the hardest. And you know, as we've grown, it's getting, I don't want to say it's getting easier because it's very hard. It's a hard business. But yeah, we're hoping to do close to 10 million in 2020.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, like everybody, we thought it would be faster, easier. It's a long road. Like, because you think about it, right? It's like, it's not just the top line. It's how you drive profitability. And the reality is, if you're selling something expensive that's high margin and you want to sell it, you want to do a better job and sell it cheaper than your competition, your margins net of service costs will be thin, which means you don't contribute that much margin for every first transaction that you have to acquire through a direct response ad channel like Facebook or Google, almost no matter what you do, right? That's just the nature of our model, which means referral and repeat is the driver of cash that finances our operations, which means that takes time. You know, so this business, if you tried to start it from scratch, you're just never going to get there.
Yeah, it will take forever. Yeah.
The momentum is hard to create. It's one of the reasons why I prefer buying things rather than building things from scratch, which you obviously know.
Clearly. But at some point, from what you told me earlier, I guess, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I guess that now you're able to say, okay, every time we get a customer, we actually get 1.2 customers because of referrals, because all these things. So just for that reason, you're able to, I guess, invest a little bit more upfront to acquire these customers, knowing that you will make more money with them down the road.
Yes. It's just that there's a few challenges, right? Number one, I have to pay for the ads upfront.
Of course, yeah.
I have to keep you, obviously, in the lifestyle to which you've grown accustomed. And it takes time. It takes time for those customers to transact, and it takes time for them to get their product, and then it takes time for them to tell a friend, and it takes time for that friend to get the product, and then it takes time for them to tell another friend. It is a snowball, and so while yes, you put in one, and you hopefully get two, but you put in one at time zero, and you get two out sometime between time zero and time four, and when matters a lot.
Of course, yeah,
you can burn a lot of cash being profitable, quote unquote, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, growth sucks cash. And so
literally,
we've fortunately been able to finance that thus far. And I think we'll now almost certainly be able to continue. But yeah, so.
Have you raised money after 2015?
Yeah.
Or not that much? Okay.
Very little. I mean, depending on how, I don't want to say very little because it's not little, but a couple million dollars. We raised $2 million total.
After 2015 and 25 or ish 30 before between 2009 and 2015.
Yeah, but the business in 2015 is a completely new business. Same name, same URL, but the entire business was wiped out.
Okay.
In other words, it's a clean cap table. It's a new business.
Okay. Okay.
New business bought the assets of the old business.
Okay, interesting. So Seth, I've other questions, another topic that I would like to discuss with you because, yeah, we're talking right now about Custom Made, clearly a successful company, but also, I don't know when you do that, actually, maybe when other people are sleeping, but you manage other businesses as well. And you bought in 2012 IGS, so International James Society. And we discussed that earlier. You've been an investment banker. You're clearly really, really good in deal structures. Can you tell us how you acquired this company in 2012? Because for people who are listening today, this company, you're getting like 5 million website visitors a year. It's a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it's been around for a long time. So that certainly helps. And we've invested a lot in content, which certainly helps. But yeah, just so your listeners know the URL, it's gemsociety.org.
Yeah, we'll put that in the notes. Yeah.
Yeah, no worries. So yeah, so they can take a look. Custom Made is custommade.com. You can spell it any way you want. We own bought all the variations over the years. Yeah, I mean, I was a gem collector starting in 2009, 2010. I've been doing it for a while. And I was a member of International Gem Society. It was a crappy old website, much like Custom Made was when I found it. The guy who started it, this guy, Don Clark, sent an e-news. He used to send this e-news letter. And he was like, I'm sick and I need to sell the business or the website. Does anybody want to buy it? And as you might guess, there was not a long line of people. You can go to the Wayback Machine and see what it looked like when I got it. I mean, I didn't have to wait in line to get my hands on this thing.
Okay.
It's a theme for me. I don't wait in line to buy stuff. You know, I'm happy to pay a premium for something I want, but usually what I want, people are just like, are you delusional? Like, you know, it's people like what's easy. So you
saw something, and that's what I think is very fascinating because you bring this company to another level. So what did you see in 2012 that you were like, hey, maybe I can bring that to another level?
I was interested in gems. Gems have been around for a long time, been a store of value for a long time. I was a member of this thing myself.
You were a customer, yeah.
The customer. And the quality of the content was an 8 out of 10. And the quality of everything else related to the business was like a 1 out of 10. So,
okay.
But what did he have that was good, right? This is kind of how I look at these things, right? Domain authority, amazing. He'd been doing this since 1998. Quality of content, it's not like this is like content that you get some guy in the Philippines off of Upwork to generate, right? This is like, how do you use a Chelsea filter in great detail, right? It's like, this is difficult stuff to create. It's expensive to create. It's valuable if you're interested in the niche. And he'd done a magical job with it. And so anyways, yeah, I thought there was a lot of value if you could just, and I just liked the content. I thought it was cool. I was like, yeah, this is awesome. So I emailed him. I was like, I'll buy this from you. How much you want for it? And he's like, $26,000. So, I mean, this is just a very basic lesson. Like, one, $26,000 is not that much money, depending on your perspective for a business. I mean, it's a lot of money if you're, you know, going to go to the club or, right? But it's not a lot of money if you're purchasing a business.
Clearly.
And so, you know, you ask someone how much they want to sell something for, and they have a very specific number like that. That's not your cue to negotiate with them.
Yeah, you say yes and go.
That's which is exactly what I did.
But it turns out it took 5 minutes, right?
Yeah, we wrote up a bunch of paperwork because I was like,
of course,
all this content, and yeah, we documented the transaction and we purchased from him. He's a good guy. The funny thing, hilariously, he passed away, unfortunately, a few months ago, actually. But he was very pleased with everything we did for the website, with the website after he, you know, because we expanded it dramatically. He's still on the website as the founder. And just hilarious random thing. This guy had years of these kits he would assemble for this gemology course, which you know about. And he just sent me crates and crates of stuff. I mean, crates of the stuff. And one of the things he sent me was a bag of rough rubies that actually was worth $10,000 or $15,000 of the purchase price. I told him about it. He's like, yeah, it's included. I was like, okay.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, it was nuts, man. We got so much. I still have bags. I mean, it was a great transaction. And you know, the coolest thing about being doing this stuff is you just meet some people. You just meet people who are cool. They might not, you know, you just meet interesting, crazy people. Crazy people. This guy's nuts, but I'm nuts too. You know, I met a lot of eccentric, interesting people who, I mean, you got to admire that guy. Like, think of how much effort he put into building this site over all these
years. Of course.
So cool. I got a lot of respect for him. Yeah, it was a good relationship. He was pleased that we were successful with it. I was pleased to buy it from him. Yeah, it's good.
Then you bought Genoxen in 2016. We'll come back after to explain to the audience where you are right now with IGS, because I think it's very, very interesting. So then you buy in 2016 Genoxen. I guess at some point, Seth, you have a process, right? You see things, like you said, there's a authority domain that you think it's really powerful. The content is good, or something is not good at some point. You see assets that people don't see. So how do you value these companies? That's a little bit my question to you today, because most of people that I know, when they're going to buy a company, they will only look at, you know, SDE, the revenue, but you saw other thing. You were not looking at necessarily the revenue. You were looking at the assets.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, if anyone had the patience to listen for what is now almost 58 minutes, I think they deserve to hear the secret sauce. So
I want to know the secret sauce. So it's fine.
So here's the core of my investment thesis. And I intend to do more of this. First of all, online websites, as you well know, just online businesses can be extremely lucrative if you are diligent and operate them like a real business. There is a whole market of these businesses that where these businesses are bought and sold. There are, for every one sophisticated operator, there's 20 people who've kind of been working on a website, making some money, but either don't have the time to scale it, don't want to scale it, but they've been doing it for a long time, and it's got a lot of authority in their niche. And ideally, it's been a resource, a real resource for a lot of people for a long time. And it ranks for lots of stuff in the niche, but the quality of the content that ranks is suboptimal. So I believe domain authority, not age of the domain, not just having an old domain, but having someone who is authoritative in their niche is worth a tremendous amount, because authority takes time to build, and therefore it's valuable. And what does authority buy you in the world of right, Google, right? So I love organic traffic because it's an annuity. It's an annuity stream of traffic. Everyone loves it. I'm not telling you anything new. But if I publish a piece of content that's the best piece of content on the web, what do I know, right? I know that all things being equal, if I publish that piece of content on an incredibly high authority, well-optimized site, the likelihood that it will rank quickly is far greater than if I just start a site from scratch. I how do you quantify that? I don't know, but I can tell you from experience it has meaningful value. So it's like in the real estate business, it's like buying a nice piece of land with a shitty house on it, right? It's the same.
Yeah. I love when you told me that the other day. I think it's really brilliant. Yeah, sorry, continue.
Yeah, so that's it. I would, first of all, I never call any of my ideas brilliant, but I appreciate you saying it. You know, it's basic stuff, right? Like so you can value a business on earnings, on income approach, what we call in real estate, what you call an income approach, right? How much income does it generate? What multiple of that income am I willing to pay? Or in real estate, it's a cap rate, which is the inverse of a multiple. It's all the same stuff. It's all division. Division or multiplication, pick which one you prefer.
Buzzwords.
They're interrelated. So yeah, I think you have to figure out how much income does it generate now and what is my potential to turn it into something that's able to generate income in the future. And most importantly, what's here that's difficult to replicate?
Like, of course.
What would be expensive to do again? What would be time consuming to do again? I mean, you've seen Gnoxon. I mean, God, we must have. And when I was buying it, I called my friends over at Rio Grande, which is a jewelry supply business. And I talked to the guy who runs tools, because we talk a lot about tools on Gnoxon on a lot of our articles. Mm-hmm. And the guy was like, oh, you bought Gnoxon. He's like, I would love to see that revive, because Gnoxon is like the Google of jewelry. It's like, well, if you're the Google of something and a guy who sells tools to people who are professional jewelers for a living thinks you're the Google of what he does, I mean,
there's other value. Yeah,
that's got to be worth something, right? A lot of people are making jewelry. A lot of people are going to keep making jewelry.
But my question for you, Seth, usually from your experience, does the seller is usually able to put a value on these assets?
Yeah,
they are.
Yeah, they are.
Okay,
but
give me an example.
But here's the thing, right? Like, so let's look at Gnoxon. I paid. I won't get into specific numbers because it's confidential, but I paid basically the equivalent of if you use seller's discretionary earnings, I paid the equivalent of almost 8 times seller's discretionary earnings.
Okay.
If you saw the website and if you saw the actual income that was the input into seller's discretionary earnings, you would be like, what? A lot of this income wasn't recurring. A lot of it couldn't be counted on, right? I'm multiplying by a foundation or a base that really I have no business multiplying by, right? In other words, it's not underwritable net income. It's not real seller's discretionary earnings. It's not likely to recur, and it's certainly not growing. It was in decline. So if you looked at it on a straight income approach valuation, you'd say, I paid too much. Now, that's what the number that he wanted. No one wanted to pay that number. Actually, he wanted a number that's 5 times higher than that. But, you know, it's like, look, so I had to stretch to get to a number that was going to satisfy him, and no one else was going to pay that number. It was less than he wanted, more than I wanted to pay, but he had some assets that he knew were valuable and I knew were valuable.
Okay, he understood it.
Yeah, he knew they were valuable, but no one else wanted to pay for them except for me. So what I did is, I mean, because what did I buy? Really, you understand the website a little bit, but, you know, I bought he had been running a forum via email since 1995. So essentially, the world's foremost experts on bench jewelry and jewelry manufacturing were corresponding, interacting, and interfacing with each other for 20 years before I bought the website. And I had 250,000 detailed how-to threads on any topic related to how to repair fine jewelry. A lot of these people aren't even alive anymore. The information is irreplaceable and incredibly detailed. So if you believe that people would like to obtain that knowledge later, there's a lot of value there.
Of course.
Put a number on it. I don't know. You know how I know it's valuable? Because tons of people have been linking to it for 20 years, which is why as soon as I put up a new piece of content on Gnoxon, it ranks immediately, right? Why? Because we're an authority in the niche. Because we spent the time to build that authority. Because of the nature and character of the relationships that underlie the business, there's meaningful value. Those are the things you need to look at and see and think about. And that doesn't mean you should go overpay for something randomly. But if you saw the income it generates now, you'd be like, oh my God, your foresight in identifying this opportunity. Like, you paid a 20th of what it's worth or whatever. Not really, right? Really, I paid twice as much as it was worth. I just saw an opportunity to leverage a lot of this value that the guy I bought it from, he's a very smart guy. He didn't want to do this anymore. He runs a cooking school now. It wasn't that he didn't recognize he had something of value. He did.
Yeah.
I didn't scheme him out of his thing and like extract value or whatever. Yeah. Like, you have to find a way to be a value oriented, not price oriented. That's my point.
And usually these guys that you bought the company, because you did that three times, Custom Made, IGS, or International Gym Society in Kinoxen.
I've done it for a few other people too. I've bought a couple companies for a few other
people. Oh, so you're an advisor.
I don't charge. a buddy of mine owns a little bit of a challenging business now for obvious reasons, but he runs a large business that sells Italian train tickets and Italian travel, and we bought Italy Magazine together, which is an old website. Helped him buy that, but I've done a bunch of this stuff.
So what's the process from the moment you buy it? You tweak a bit the business model. That's how you see it, or you change the content, because, like you said, IGS doesn't look the same that it looked before, right? It's a complete different business.
Yeah, I mean, the process is we reinvest aggressively in the business. You know, we try to find something that generates revenue. We try to grow the revenue, and then we take whatever's left and we invest in the business, and we keep growing and we keep growing and growing. Like, we didn't become the largest gymology website in the world for any reason, in all honesty, other than the fact that we were willing to invest heavily in content when other people were not. Heavily. We're number one because we've spent seven figures on content creation over many years. Other people in my situation might have taken that money and put it in their bank account and let the business do what the business will do. You know, the question I have to ask myself is, would I rather have the revenue stream going forward, or would I rather have had that money in my bank account? And I choose to reinvest aggressively in the businesses. Frankly, there are better businesses than ours that are under their owners just don't invest in them aggressively. You can make money just buying businesses where the owner is unwilling to invest their profit and you're willing to invest your profit. You've seen that in your own business. I mean, you have people, I'm sure, who are getting returns on ad spend that make my returns on ad spend look offensively low. And you're like, don't you want to quadruple your ad spend? And they're like, no, I'm capped at whatever, $5,000 a month, right?
Of course.
Of course. I'd kill for that business. By the way, if any of those businesses are for sale, you gotta look.
Oh my God, Seth. Yeah. I will look for you, because yeah, this is true. It's not everybody that, you know, that want to grow. But I think it's different, and it's something that comes from culture at some point. Some people are happy with the kind of lifestyle business that they have, and they don't necessarily see the value of just reinvesting,
sure,
increasing the revenue, improving the company, making more profit. At some point, people sometimes are just happy with what they have, which is something that I don't understand, because it's always interesting to just grow and grow and grow and making better things. But, you know, for some people, it's okay.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's no, I mean, as I'm getting older, I don't judge anyone for anything anymore. I recognize there's a million different ways to get to the promised land. That this has worked for me. It doesn't mean it's going to work for your listeners. Like, this is just my
opinion. Of course. So what's coming next for Seth Rosen? Like, it looks like Custom Made is doing well. IGS and Genoxen, your two other businesses, look like they grow also. So how do you see the future for the next 5-10 years? Do you want to buy more businesses? What's the end game with Custom Made? Can you tell us more about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'd love to buy more of these because they do well. They're a lot of work. You know, none of this stuff is this. I love listening to, you know, you listen to these podcasts, people are like, passive income. It's like, I don't even know what that means. Like, it's not passive. Like, there's nothing passive about income.
It's active income. Active.
Like, I have been managing these things aggressively and actively for many years, which is why they now generate meaningful income. And I would like that to improve. But the reality is, like, you know, there's only so many hours in the day. So a lot of what I'm focused on is empowering my teams and people to really step up and run the playbook that we've proven works over time in the way that we've proven it works, right? Which is, and it's not so easy. It's like, I can write down the recipe and other people can't really cook it. You know, it's hard.
Of course.
It's so, you know, scaling it out in an intelligent and thoughtful way. As you know, I have a soft spot in my heart for my neighbors to the north, like everyone who seems to be any Canada seems to be my source of, like, I have stay-at-home moms in the United States, and Canadians seems to be my entire workforce. So it's...
are you going to move in Canada?
No, I just got to find more, you know, I got to find more more of your countrymen to give me a hand, you know.
It's perfect because people who are listening, most of them are from Canada. So maybe you'll find other partners here, right?
I would love that. I would love that. I just had tremendous luck. It's interesting. My guy with my buddy with the Italian train ticket business is a Canadian guy who lives in the United States. And he
also
his whole oh. Canada. I've just had great luck. I found people tend to do high quality work. The wages tend to be reasonable relative to the U.S. There's less, it's obviously nothing against the U.S., but there's less over-promising and under-delivering.
It happens a lot in the U.S. You saw it?
Very common. I'm sure everywhere, but it's particularly
important.
But, you know, also a lot of it is, as we've gotten a little bigger, and this is a lesson I've learned, right? Like, when you get a little bigger, you can sort of afford to do things right rather than do things twice. And that's made a big difference.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, you can pay folks like J7 Media to do your Facebook or Matt who does my design work. It's like, you know, it's expensive, but you get a great quality product and, you know, you pay peanuts and you get monkeys.
Of course. No, it's true. It's true. It happens in every verticals, right?
Yes.
At some point, you will always get better results if you pay a bit, you know, it's a bit more expensive, but you get more quality at the end of the day.
Definitely.
And so, Seth, tell me, is there, before we finish the recording, do you have a specific routine? Like, a lot of people that I interview, they're telling me, hey, I do this in the morning, I do this at night, that's how I structure my journey. Is there something like that with you, or?
Yeah. It's interesting. A lot of my entrepreneurial buddies are like, I don't know what you call it. Health hacking, life hacking, body hacking, quantified self. My buddy Dave Hauser is super into a lot of this stuff, and I give him a lot of crap. And he's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant guy. But my routine is, it is not that profound. Now homeschooling my children because of coronavirus. So my routine is insane right now. But usually I don't like waking up very early.
Oh, so you don't?
No, I kind of wake up when I want to wake up, or when they wake me up, usually the latter. And then, yeah, I like to, I immediately want to check in on all the work stuff that's going on. So I do that first thing before I do anything else.
So you look at the emails and all these different things?
Yeah, I tend to look at stuff that's actionable first, and then I look at sales and stuff like that. And then some things I'm just not that interested in them, so I should look at them and I don't. And I just have a million projects going on, so I have multiple Slacks going all the time. I have wikis where we organize all of our work. I do not like meetings, so we have very few meetings.
I think it's perfect, right? I think it's perfect to not have a lot. Everything can be done through emails at some point.
I mean, you know, how often... You know, you're like, do you want to jump on a call? And I'm like, well, I mean, do we need to? Because what do we need to know? You know, like, I don't mind meetings where, like, we're communicating. I like meetings where we're communicating around ideas. So I will put some of that into my schedule. I do not like update meetings. I know some people love them, like same page update meetings or whatever. It's like, if I want to know what you're working on, I should be able to go to a wiki or an email or a work plan, read the plan, evaluate what you're working on, answer my own questions. If I have questions that are specific to what I want to know, I can email you and ask them, or Slack you and ask them. And then if we need to have a meeting around new ideas or something that's abstract, we should have a meeting around that. But I really don't like, hey, let me tell you what we're working on type of meeting. So I get a lot of time back because I don't do that stuff.
Of course.
But I don't have, if you're looking like, I'm not micro-dosing LSD and then doing the Wim Hof bath and my breathing exercises after I do, like, I'm not eating on a pierogi-only diet. Like, I try to eat fewer calories and exercise more, which...
Do you read a lot?
I read a shitload, yeah.
Okay, tell me what you're reading right now.
I'm...
Have you read this one?
Oh, yeah. I haven't read that.
Okay, so people who are listening, I'm showing Seth right now the book, The Everything Store, the book on the story of Jeff Bezos, which I think is completely fascinating. I just finished this book a couple of weeks ago, and honestly, you can see why Amazon is so strong right now. A guy that keep the same vision for 25 years, always say the same thing, and then agree for 10 years to lose millions, millions, millions every year, and tells his investor it's normal, it's coming, and then at some point become the wealthiest person in the world. I think it's completely fascinating.
Yeah, I have read the book, but I can imagine, and I've said this to many people over the years, but it's sort of a key learning for me, is like, diversification does not mitigate risk. Focus mitigates risk. And what I think Bezos did really well is he just focused on the customer experience. He's like, I just want to make it really easy. It's not that complicated. It's very complicated, but it's not that complicated. It's like,
of course.
So I like to focus things down to like core principles. Like, what are we in the business of doing? At IGS, we're in the business of helping people get educated about gems. That's our business. We need to do that really well. We need to keep doing it better. At Custom-Made, we're in the business of making people really happy on one of their most meaningful purchases. It's like, these are very, very simple. You have to boil things down to something that's pretty, pretty simple. But yeah, to answer your question, I'm reading a bunch of stuff by Ray Dalio right now.
Okay.
So he actually, it's online, but it's principle. He's putting a bunch of it online, principles.com. He's got chapter one and chapter two up. Pretty interesting. I've been listening to a lot of his YouTube videos. I love YouTube. I'm like a YouTube addict.
Okay. So you watch a lot of, what kind of videos basically are you going to watch?
So I first of all, I probably spend 20% of every day reading.
So it's important for you.
Yeah. And then I probably spend another 10% of every day, like either listening in the background or actively watching, like almost always interviews around topics that I'm interested in with people who I think are interested, or very like specific things I'm interested in learning more about, like the market for precious metals, or like gardening, or like anything. Like, you know, I have not read, I read no fiction, which is probably not good. I've read a bunch of fiction in my life, but I literally, in the last 5 years, read, I can't tell you the last. It's all very nonfiction.
Do you read a lot of business books?
You know, I don't really.
Oh, interesting.
I don't. I feel that, I read a ton of business books, and I kind of feel like business books a little bit about the way I feel about movies. You know, it's like I've sort of seen a lot of the themes, and now I'm seeing a lot of the themes come up again and just sort of approach in a different way.
Okay, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, I really prefer to engage around like ideas and trends. But yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not averse to business books.
So what's the trend right now? What do you see that can be something that you would invest money at some point in the next couple of years that you think is really growing?
Well, I think this internet thing is going to take off.
oh my God, Seth.
I think the whole market, I really do think the whole market for, first, I think SaaS is going nowhere. I think SaaS is a fantastic market. I'm an investor in a few venture funds and I wouldn't call them venture funds, private equity funds that buy SaaS businesses. I think SaaS is a fundamentally fantastic space. I think it's going to continue to expand, right?
It's just that the business model looks like most of these companies, none of them are profitable. They lose so much money with investors that are willing to invest drastically, only focusing on revenue. They never focus on profit. Do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to generalize, right? Like inherently, what are you really doing, right? You have to put a bunch of capital in up front to get a salesperson to sell your software and get someone on it. And then you have to build a product that actually solves a real customer problem.
Of course.
But those revenue streams are, if done well, extremely sticky, extremely valuable, and all margin, right? I mean, content, SaaS, all of these like online businesses that are infinitely scalable, where you can distribute the labor, So you're arbitraging labor costs, right? I mean, it's cheaper to hire in Canada than it is in the US. That's why I have a lot of Canadian folks, right? They're better and they're cheaper. Like, it's not, you know what I mean? And my Canadian counterparts are happy to get paid in US dollars. It's a win-win-win, right? And that's,
of course, yeah.
Structurally, my businesses are set up to take advantage of that. If we ran an extermination business, you're not going to come down from Canada and spray the side of my house and then go back up to Canada, right? So clearly, the business has to be structured in a way to take advantage of these trends, right? So I think remote labor and remote work, online-based, high-margin, software-driven, experience-based, if it's retail or e-commerce, right? If it's I believe commodity commerce is total shit. I think it's not going to work. I know there's a whole bunch of companies raising money for this, these FBA roll-up opportunities where they're buying marginal FBA companies that are fulfillment by Amazon, for those people to know, that are, you know, they're selling commodity products. Like, at a certain point, if your business is not differentiable and durable, you're playing musical chairs. I think it's a dangerous game. So I like businesses that have something that's hard to replicate. And I think it takes time to build. And that's what I try to buy. That's where I think things are moving. That's where I think people should be focused. There are certain business models that I just completely stay away from.
Tell me more.
In the like, you know, there's things I truly believe no one should ever invest in. Some of them are things that I've done, like the restaurant business is a terrible business.
Oh my God, yeah. So good to go to restaurants, but especially right now, we can see that, right?
This is like a perfect, I mean, this is a...
Oh my God.
What can happen, but... Yeah, is a business fundamentally good or is a business fundamentally bad? Mm-hmm. And I think that if your listeners are trying to take something away, I think opportunity identification, like knowing what a really good business looks like is this core skill, one of the core skills that you want to keep developing.
And let's say in three words, how would you say a business is a really good opportunity? High margin, something that you can replicate?
Yeah, I mean... High margin, scalability. I mean, ideally something you create once and sell many, 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 many times for many, many, many years.
Interesting.
You know, and a logical person would say, well, what the hell are you making custom jewelry for? And what you're doing it one off. It's the opposite of the advice you're giving. And the response is the jewelry is something I'm making one time. The relationship inherently is compounding. And that's where the magic is. My compounded revenue stream is the strength of the relationships I forge with my customers. My service model is a capital investment in that relationship.
Interesting. Very interesting podcast, Seth.
I hope so. I can't believe someone would listen this long, but if they have, I am.
They will. People who are listening to podcasts, usually I look at the stats. If the conversation is interesting, they will listen all of it. Okay. There's a ton of value here. Before we let you go, so custom made if people are looking for an engagement ring, IGS if people want to know more about gemology, and Genoxian if they want to learn more about jewelry making.
Yes. And if you go to custommade.com, we do ship to Canada all the time.
Of course.
We make more than engagement rings. Engagement rings are our primary business, but we make signet rings. Believe it or not, we're probably the largest custom signet ring manufacturer in the US by now. We make custom class rings if you're got a master's degree from one school and a bachelor's degree from another, and you only want to wear one ring. Like, we make super meaningful gifts for your wife or your girlfriend or your mistress, you know, whatever. I mean, you want to make it, we will make it for you.
Exactly. That's what Custom Made is all about. Okay, great. Thanks very much, Seth. I think it was quite fascinating, and I'm pretty sure people will think the same thing. Thanks again, and see you soon for a new episode of Hyper Croissance. J'espère que le premier épisode d'Hyper Croissance en anglais vous a plu. Personnellement, ce fut un plaisir du début à la fin de discuter affaires avec Seth. Ses connaissances sur l'acquisition d'entreprises et également sa vision sur le monde des affaires me fascinent grandement. Je vous invite également à nous donner une note de 5 étoiles sur iTunes ou sur votre plateforme de podcast préférée si vous avez aimé l'épisode d'aujourd'hui. J'aimerais également vous entendre à savoir ce que vous avez pensé de notre premier épisode en anglais. Est-ce que c'est quelque chose qu'on devrait refaire? Sur ce, on se dit à bientôt pour un prochain épisode de Hyper Croissance.